Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're joined by Maddie.
Boo, 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 boo.
To talk about Mabinogi from 2003, a film about Welsh mythology. A full transcript will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Good evening, Ren.
Good evening, Matty.
Hi!
Matty's here, our Welsh correspondent.
Thanks! Like so many so-called correspondents, I know a bit of something maybe about the subject I've been brought in to talk about.
Perfect. That's what we want to hear.
But, Ren, I know you do Welsh on Duolingo, right?
Yes.
So, I'm ready for some pronunciations, mate.
Oh, good.
I'm sorry to tell you, there is not a lot about parsnips in this film. So, Ren's at a little bit of a disadvantage.
I am, yeah. There was nothing about parsnips, nor leeks, or the verb to iron. So.
Smoothie-ar.
That's fair. If I'm not talking about different coloured potatoes, I can't speak Czech very well. So.
It's less hot now because it's 7:30, but it has been very hot here. So, we'll blame any lapses of concentration or knowledge or Welsh pronunciation on the
or
heat.
English pronunciation, to be fair. you're gonna get what you're gonna get. It's live, sort of.
Well, yeah, I guess one of the consequences of climate change that maybe hasn't been taken seriously enough, the impact on our podcasting abilities.
Yeah.
Where's that in the UN reports?
It's the way that you said that, like those adverts for like for £4.99 a month you can rescue this donkey from weird donkey hell that no one's quite sure where it is or why it exists. Like, for £5 a month you can mitigate climate change consequences against podcasters. And like, it's absolutely a money laundering scheme.
Yeah,
well, So today, as far as I can tell, things were left on a slightly uncertain note, although it was a kind of escort you to the door level of uncertain note. I might have managed to basically have lost a job before I actually got to sign the contract. So,
I mean, speedrun strats, but oh no.
Yeah, because, you know, just, and this should get some subscribers, right? I'm donating a kidney.
Yeah, he is.
Which is great, and it's going to be really helpful to the recipient, but I'm afraid an HR department does not consider it so good, because it means that I'd probably have to have cover for like 2 weeks, and I'm afraid that doesn't cut it in the harsh world of HR, by the looks of it. So, but that's okay, because I've been cheered up by a film about some bickering siblings in ye olde Wales.
2003, like, to be precise.
So much happens. Did you watch the Welsh version?
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Welsh language version with the live bits. One of my favourite things about it is that it does demonstrate what I have asserted about Pembrokeshire, which is Pembrokeshire in the early 2000s, all the fashion was current, everything else was the 70s.
Okay, so, Matty, do you want to introduce this film? Because I don't know, is this a film that you suggested to Ren, or is it a film, Ren, that you came across?
Matty suggested it.
Yeah, this is my fault. I can't actually remember how I've seen this. I have definitely seen it multiple times. It's possible that my secondary school had the local cinema in it. Because it needed to be somewhere. And it's possible when this came out, we were all herded to go and watch the big animated film in Welsh.
I mean, there is... So what's... Let's get out of the way. What is the name of the film?
Its name is Y Mabinogi, and the English translation was Otherworld. I've never actually seen a title card for it called anything other than Y Mabinogi. And it is based on a series of Welsh tales written in the Middle Ages, with a... Does it count as a modern twist? A modern bookend?
Yeah, a modern framing device. So it starts in live action, ends in live action, and the bulk of the film is kind of... animated sort of rotoscope.
Yeah, so there's bits of rotoscoping, possibly some traditional frame animation, and then occasional bits of CGI.
Mm. And rotoscoping, for people who don't know, is when you draw over the live action film.
Yeah. You kind of, like, film a film and then trace over it and make it cooler.
Yeah, it's why Snow White in the Disney original Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs looks all kind of loosey-goosey and fluid compared to some of the other characters.
Hmm.
Well, kind of loosey-goosey. No, I don't know if that's quite right. Anyway, she was rotoscoped and the rest of the film wasn't.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Huh.
And Ralph Bakshi's Lord of the Rings as another well-known question mark?
Other film that is...
I should just laugh at the mention of Ralph Bakshi's name. That's me. Poor Ralph Bakshi.
No, not... Ralph Bakshi had exactly the life that he wanted. Like, that dude is fine.
Making troubling, problematic, weirdly animated films, yeah.
Hmm.
Is, yeah. So, and this is a weird... This isn't like Ralph Bakshi weird, but it's a pretty good... So that, like, the Mabinogion is a collection of, like, the early, like, well, some of the earliest Welsh prose stories. They were compiled in the 12th and 13th century from different sources. This is basically an example of oral tradition being written down. So on one hand, you have, when oral traditions are written down, often there are lots of things that don't necessarily get included because everyone knows the story because it's an oral tradition. So beyond the fact that over history details get lost or context is lost, there's also just an amount of, like, why were they being written down? Why were they being collected? Informs what gets written down. They've also gone on a wild journey the Victorians got them, for one. And the Victorians love just adding stuff to things. So... this film is brilliant and does a in as far as it's a bit, like, it can be a little difficult to follow.
Yeah.
That's actually a pretty decent representation of the stories. both in as far as life as we live it is a bit intense. Life with a bit of magic and it's going to be a bit more intense. And yeah, just the way that they have been transferred through history as, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm getting that helps explain to me. I've written down a note of how fast things erupt into chaos. If that makes sense. So like, you're getting characters doing something and then it's like suddenly everyone's killing each other and it's like, what? It didn't seem to take much provocation. Like,
yeah.
And it's things are on fire and it happens very quickly.
Yeah, and presumably if you were telling these, if you were an oral storyteller, if you needed to keep a bunch of people really interested for 4 hours, you would pan the ass out of telling these stories. And if you needed to get people's attention on you immediately, you go to the bloody bits quite quickly.
Yeah.
So like there's lots of different ways of telling these sorts of stories, and the people who were being told the stories knew what it meant. In the same way as, like, I don't know, the villain's always backlit, you know? Like we know the villain's always backlit.
Yeah.
And humans throughout history have had, in stories, their ways of showing, like, no, this is the bad guy. Like, I don't need to tell you it's the bad guy. He's 12th century Welsh backlit. But it doesn't necessarily translate to someone coming in with no previous knowledge seeing something on the screen. So it is kind of like, I really strongly recommend watching it, but it is very much one of those, like, just watch it for what it is and let it wash over you. Don't look for plot holes. Don't try to just experience it.
Okay.
Just experience my weird culture.
So do you think this was made, because I don't know really anything about its production apart from what I read on Wikipedia, and you mentioned that you think you watched this in cinema in school. And I noted down early on that it does have a bit of a kind of look and read feel to proceedings. So for those of you outside of the UK, look and read was a kind of, I guess, government initiative TV education scheme that was brought into schools, primary schools, for like English teaching and to increase vocabulary. So the one that I've mentioned before and really stayed with me was Through the Dragon's Eye, which starts off, I mean, it's all live action, but it starts off in a kind of playground, and then this girl, that there's a painting of a dragon, like a mural, on the outside school wall in the playground, and then the dragon winks at them, and it comes to life and beckons them into the enchanted realm, and so they kind of go through the dragon's eye into this fantasy land, and then it kind of focuses on teaching you very important words like Vita Core, which is the source of all power within Palamir, the magical realm of Through the Dragon's Eye. So it'll say Vita Core, V-E-T-A C-O-R-E, Vita Core. But yeah, so this to me had, I think it was probably that live action book ending that we're sort of starting with these characters, and clearly we're meant to realise at some point that the kind of problems in their lives are mirrored by the problems in the lives of these sort of, I guess, early medieval Welsh characters. So it's like, you know, there's one of them, you know, is anxious about being pregnant, and then there's pregnancy issues going on in this, and another character finds out that his parents aren't who he thought they were, and he's adopted, and then we've got a mythical character who was adopted. So you've got this kind of mirroring between the live action segments, and I did wonder if that was deliberately to try to say to teenagers watching, like, hey, look, you see, this stuff is relevant. It's not just old stories. It relates to your own lives.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because like the live action bits at the beginning and the start, like I don't know. So this is absolutely like supposition. But they really had the vibe of teen, like Welsh teen drama.
Okay.
Like, there is a Wales has a Welsh language television channel called S4C, and it is government funded, and it has all the things that television channel would have, including the Welsh equivalent of Biker Grove, like the Welsh yeah. equivalent of Top of the Pops, like all the Welsh equivalent of Newsround. And the segments at the beginning and the end of Mabinogi really reminded me of the admittedly quite small amount of that I watched as a teenager.
Okay.
Because obviously, like, it's government, I don't mean government like the man's controlling your telly. I mean, like, it's message-driven television. There's no, like, it's not advertising, like, advertiser-led. It's, you know, very, like, the... Wait, Wales is not a big country, and it's like people are quite like. Anyway,
I mean,
so part of me wondered if like the reason that was the way it was just that's just how people were writing teen stuff at the time.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
But what you were saying about what was it?
Look and Read.
Stop speaking. Look and Read. This film was made in 2003, but it's based on a comic book by Mike Collins, which was made in 2001. And he actually worked, well, probably still does actually, but I can't be sure, but as a key illustrator for Welsh language school books, making comic strips aimed at reluctant learners. So... I don't know if there is any connection there other than that's a really sweet little coinkydink. But this film is based on a comic book of a Mabinogion, and basically any contemporary work that's based on those texts is usually based on a more contemporary translation. Like, you can go to like Aberystwyth and the big old books are tucked away in a library somewhere in Wales, I think in Aberystwyth, but like people don't work off of those. They work off of more contemporary translations.
Okay.
So again, it is that like message through different mediums through time.
I mean, I also noted that, and this was like the first note I made, that they had a bit of an animated Shakespeare vibe. So
yeah.
And it turns out it was something like the same production company, or at least some of the people who were involved in the animated Shakespeare, I think The Tempest, which is actually very good. And yeah, I really like that one. And The Winter's Tale was also involved in this. So yeah, there is a loose connection to animated Shakespeare as well, which again maybe gave it that slight kind of educational feel.
Yeah, it's definitely got an educational flavour to it, I think.
Which I say, yeah, I don't necessarily regard as a bad thing. Like, I think on this podcast I'm on record saying that I'm actually very fond of, like, edutainment. And the animated version of The Tempest from Animated Shakespeare, whenever I've taught The Tempest, I've used it. I think it's, you know, really wonderful piece of stop-motion animation.
What we haven't mentioned is that one of the young people, one of our teens at the beginning, is a young Matthew Rhys with frosted tips.
Yeah.
I didn't notice.
Yeah. of the Americans and other things that aren't the Americans, but I just associate him with the Americans.
I know. Just the idea of like a headcanon consistency that like Slay ends up defecting to Russia and then ends up doing terrible things.
The live action segments, I don't know if they're wholly necessary. There's another version, so there are two versions of this uploaded to YouTube. One which is in its original Welsh language, and another one which is dubbed. And the dubbed version only has the animated segments, interestingly. It doesn't have the live-action book ending.
Yeah.
Mm.
Although the live-action book ending does seem to be connected to myth, and a kind of myth that reminded me of Laputa, the castle in the sky. I mean, I know that... and I only mention this because I know that Miyazaki quite likes his European and his, you know, I think of his Welsh influences on Diana Wynne Jones adaptation, obviously Howl's Moving Castle, and possibly Mary and the Witch's Flower. But yeah, this idea of an island that kind of appears at certain times, or a floating island, which you have in Miyazaki. I did wonder if he'd taken it from, like, Welsh mythology, because there's this... So the portal, as far as I understood it, into this kind of mythic realm of the past is this sort of island that emerges Atlantis-like, like, from the sea, off the coast of Wales or something?
They're at Grasholm Island. Like, that seems to be where they're going, which is... past Skomer Island off the like the southern end of Pembrokeshire.
Okay.
And there's a little bit of text at the end that goes into it a little bit more. But, like, I wasn't totally clear as to whether the portal was an island that appears, and also there was also a real island.
Yeah.
But like, there's quite a few islands that appear out of West Wales, well, out of the Irish Sea, essentially. So it's entirely possible Miyazaki got it from one of them.
Mm.
Pretty sure it got at least two.
I mean, yeah, I quite liked that. And then you get this sort of strange bit of animation where the live action morphs into rotoscoping.
Mm-hmm.
And where Matthew Rhys just cannonballs into the sea, which I did enjoy. You just, yeah, just grab your knees and fling yourself into mythology time.
But it is quite odd, right? Because it's like the live actors are then trapped in their animated forms, partly because it's rotoscoped, but also it's very unclear as to whether they're inhabiting these sort of mythologic ancient figures, whether they're just observing what's happening. It seems like they're experiencing what they experienced, like, vicariously or something.
If I had to guess, and I haven't been able to find much information about this, but if I had to guess, the live-action bits are only in Welsh, because they were for a Welsh domestic audience...
Mm.
For teens to watch on telly, and so that was just a bit of getting extra messaging in there, making it extra relevant and interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Or ticking whatever we need to tell the teenagers to not have unprotected sex messaging that there needs to be. Because I love that she's like, "Oh no, I had sex last night. Guess I'm pregnant." Like, it's 2003. Like, there are plenty of things that you can do. Yeah. It's not just like, "Well, I guess I'm a mum." No, that doesn't. All right then. But the dub. Was it's pretty much all the same actors doing the dub, because the vast majority of Welsh people can also speak English, and the, like, all Welsh actors can act in English and in Welsh if they speak Welsh. So I imagine it was just either they didn't want to re-record the live action bits in English, or it was just, this is not relevant to a market outside of Wales. Like, this is just here so that we're talking to the youth, but the grown adults buying the DVD do not need to know about this guy finding out that he adopted, which does mean that they miss out on one of the best bits of the whole film, which is the blue camo print Lada Riva estate at the start. This is the best car that has ever existed.
So
we don't often get car talk on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever seen any of the Phantasm films, Matty?
No.
Well,
I'm excited for possible ladders, though.
Because me and my friend Andy, who is the landlord of the Brewer's Arms in Ipswich and has his own podcast. I think it's Beyond the Graves and Stars, or possibly the other way around. But anyway, we've been reviewing the Phantasm franchise on there because the idea is he kind of likes to review horror series that have a whole bunch of sequels. And
so, like, the Kamen Rider of horror.
And Phantasm has a whole bunch of sequels. But doing the podcast, one thing I'd read about Phantasm is that petrolheads really like it because apparently the models of cars are very specifically chosen and there's quite a few car explosions. And me and Andy, you know, neither of us drive and I don't know anything about cars. So I'm very aware that there's probably a whole bunch of people, if they're listening to it, who like Phantasm because of the cars. And we're just like, yeah, don't even know what model car that was.
Brilliant. Excellent.
But there aren't any cars in the animated sequences because we're in the ye olde mists of I mean, what century are we dealing with, roughly?
12th? 13th?
Somewhere between dinosaur time and now. like we're looking, like we're looking medieval. Like these were written down in the, well, like collected in the 12th and 13th century. But
I mean, this is clearly a period in which there are clans. That's what I gather. Like I'm picturing it a bit like, I guess, a bit like the Scotland of Macbeth, right? That there are lots of clans who occasionally fight each other. I'm no expert here.
No, you are pretty much spot on. In as far as like most. Like we're sort of pre the modern concept of nations at this point. Like we're really looking at like about 1040 or something till about, yeah. We sort of start knocking up against like the annexation of Wales. So yeah, 11th and 12th century. And yeah, there were just a lot of different kingdoms within kingdoms within kingdoms, yeah, within kingdoms, yeah, nesting like little Russian dolls.
Yeah, yes. I think because of that, I find it quite hard to follow some of the geography, but I got as much as that there seemed to be a lot of fighting between Welsh clansmen and Irish clansmen, I think.
Yeah. So it was broadly set in Aberdeen, which is in Pembrokeshire, and they were up north for the bits with they're in Howlach for the bits with Bran, Bendigeidfran the giant, and fighting the Irish. They're in Gwynedd for Pwyll, so they're in three geographic areas, and then because Wales isn't very big, some of the people turn up in some of the other areas. It doesn't take long to get around, to be honest. so like the three characters have the places where their stories are based, and yeah, it does just kind of throw you around and just like exposition text comes up or just says you're here now and you're like, cool.
but this giant, so what's the giant's name again?
Bendigeidfran.
Okay, so Bendigeidfran? Gran?
Yeah. You smashed it, mate.
Sure, okay, right. So, he's not always been a giant, as far as I could tell. It seemed like he started off as a regular man, and then Incredible Hulk-like got so angry he became a giant. Is that right? Or
I mean, he was always like,
I think he was a big guy.
Yeah,
sure.
He was always like would make the Undertaker look like a normal sized
comic. Yeah, yeah.
And then when he's mad, gets like, I don't know, like, I'm a ship now.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Big.
I mean, that's quite a big difference.
Yeah. I think the implication is that he's like, it looks like he's maybe about 8 or 9 foot tall, which is pretty giant, and gets ingianted when you lock his sister in a kitchen.
So yeah, why did he get so angry?
Well, he gets so angry because this is the part of the story that Dan is involved in, who is one of our teens.
Love Dan.
But
Dan's the best.
He's not as central to this, to his strand of the story, as the other two are. Well, he gets more important, but
okay.
To begin with, he's sort of there as part of Bendigate Friend's entourage.
He does. Well, he's Bendigate, one of the brothers.
Oh, yeah.
And he consistently has the most sense out of everyone, which I really like about his character. Because, like, these, if you've got the live-action bit, like, these three people are, like, learning about themselves through the medium of their experiences with the mythology. And mostly what Dan seems to learn is, like, oh, I'm not actually an idiot. I'm just, like, I'm a bit late for stuff sometimes. But he does do his best to try and prevent multiple international incidents.
yeah, because the King of Ireland, Math Wallach, appears off the coast with a fleet of boats, and says he wants to marry Branwen, who is the king's, or is Bendigeid Friend's sister.
Yeah,
yeah, and so they're like, well, this does seem like it would be good for relations between our countries. So sure, but
they have a really angry racist brother called Evnissien, who they're like, I'm sure if we arrange a wedding feast to marry our sister to the Irish, who he is super racist about.
He really, really hates Irish
people.
Won't
find out and do anything. Yeah, he's not about them. And they're like, oh, no, but this is a good decision. It will be fine. Like, everyone has someone in their life who really doesn't like conflict and thinks that if they just try hard enough, they can make reality not involve people doing unreasonable things. And this is kind of like the very extreme, like, no, he's going to lose his temper and stab all the horses.
Yeah. Evnissien stabs all the horses.
And I guess this is where the kind of horror comes in, right? Because at first I was quite confused. Not confused, because, you know, it's an interesting animated film that's vaguely for kids. But, like, obviously at first I thought, this isn't horror. But I think the aspects that make it, and it, maybe it's more dark fantasy, but I think what I mentioned, like, how fast things erupt into chaos, and I think it's that which is horrifying, because things just ticking along, and then suddenly things are really bloody and violent.
Mm. Horses are being slashed. Yeah.
Yeah, and it is, again, it's one of those things that they don't go into because the film would be, like, a million years long. But, like, you know, for us, obviously, we're like, those horses didn't do anything wrong. That's horrible that you slashed up these horses. Like, you know, you're a bad person. But, like, horses are incredibly significant in Irish culture. And, like, lots of cultures, like, they are big, strong, powerful freedom providers. Like, if you imagine how, like, adverts want us to feel about cars, is how people actually feel about horses.
Oh, I see. And so it's like,
if they are.
Yeah.
Who you are really, when you are really on your horse is, like, the true, like, completion of you.
Yeah.
Like, that is agency, that is power. So, like, and, you know, connections to, because horses are pretty, I don't know how much time you spend on horses, but they're pretty magic. Destroying things that are, like, holy to you.
Okay.
And that it's so wanton and violent. It's really, like, intense, which they do not make a big deal out of, because, like, as I'm explaining it, I'm like, man, I am saying too much. So they're just kind of, like, got to be like, the man cut up the horses. It's not good to cut up the horses.
Okay, so is this, and I'm sorry I'm asking so many questions, because I think part of recording this podcast is just trying to make this film clear in my head, because not knowing really any Welsh mythology going into it, it was quite a confusing experience. Like, not a bad experience, and as you say, like, maybe it makes sense to have the telling of these stories be kind of rhythmically a bit weird, like rushed in some bits and then slowing down and then really fast. Like, that makes a certain amount of sense, but it means that the experience of watching it, if you're not familiar, is sometimes quite overwhelming and confusing. So was the killing of the horses something that then prompted the appearance of this wicker bone-headed horse monster?
The wicker bone-headed horse monster is in the other story.
Okay.
that's in the first story that the story that begins the film, that's down in Narberth. Which is funny to me, because it's like the town up the road from the village I grew up in. It's like, oh, my Narberth.
So
I've sat and drunk cider in that castle.
Does that creature have like a special? I mean, I just thought it's like a hobby horse. That's the name I think of, like skeleton horses. But does it have a special name?
Not that I can. It's worth. As we said at the start, while we were still setting up and trying to work out how to make microphones work, like, I sound really reassuring and like I know what I'm talking about, but I want to be very clear that I am not passing on any scholarship here. I'm passing on what is in my mind and my person from being like, from having all of this stuff be like part of the general like seawater that I was raised in, like the briny soup that I
you
rose
were pickled
out
in.
Yeah, it's the pickle brine.
Yeah.
It's like, this is like the mustard seeds and the pickle brine, but like, I could highly encourage people to go and check out different translations of these stories and like find out more. But if anything I say sounds really good, just treat it like I'm just another oral storyteller telling the story. That doesn't mean I'm telling you anything accurate.
So did anything cause that creature? Did anything make it, or did it just appear like a kind of agent of like, is it just like Grendel in Beowulf? Like, it's just this monster.
Are you talking about when it comes and nicks that baby?
Yeah.
Well, that's because Rhiannon was meant to marry one dude. She didn't want to marry him, so she went and found the other dude and was like, what up, do you want to marry me? What up, do you love me? And the guy was like, Poyser was like, I mean, I'd be a fool to say no, wouldn't I? So yes, I do. So there was a bit of a red wedding situation, actually, wherein, like, you were meant to marry one person and you married someone else, and the baby getting stolen is a bit of a, like, wizardly consequence of that.
Okay. Yeah, because I just felt...
not the wizard later, a different wizard.
Yeah, I guess I just sort of like, well, what's it got to do with you, bone horse? Like, it just seemed like appear and be really awful. I was like, oh my gosh, it's just taken up this poor baby. I was like, why? What's it doing? And this is a bit of CGI animation, so it looks pretty demented.
Yeah. But doesn't it look so much better than it has any right to?
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. It's pretty awesome.
Oh.
Can we do texture of the week? Because, you know...
Yeah, let's do it.
Is there an obvious translation of texture of the week into Welsh? Sadly, we're not
there
using
is.
The webcam, so I can't see Matty's expression at my very reasonable request.
I mean, like, there is. Do I know it? That's a beautiful question.
Penwythnos. No, it's a weekend.
Penwythnos. But, so if pen is end.
Yeah. Weeknos.
Boom. Got it.
What?
It means week.
Yeah. Okay, so what do we need to say?
Utterly Snouse, Beef of the Week. I cannot remember off the top of my head what texture is, though.
Yeah.
So, texture. Texture, Utterly Snouse.
Hey.
Oh, that's nice.
Just take the English word and say it a bit Welsh. It'll do. You can fix it in post.
I thought that sounded really nice.
Thank you, Matty.
Thank you. Yeah. So mine is this Wicca boneheaded horse monstrosity, because especially as rendered in early 2000s CGI, it looks incredibly metal. It looks like it's just stepped out of some kind of ridiculous new metal music video, straight into the medieval Welsh past to snatch up babies and cause havoc.
Yeah, it does look like the back projection for like some profoundly problematic like doom metal band.
yeah.
Like, that thing's just in the background destroying stuff while they're playing like 40-minute long songs that absolutely slap, and then you look at the lyrics and you're like, oh no. Oh, that man went to prison for reasons why people should go to prison.
But anyway, I was all there for it. You could definitely imagine it as some kind of terrifying puppet on stage, and that would be great.
Oh yeah. My texture was they have sort of little bits of interstitial bits of live action scenery, like real scenery that are then sort of
They do actually
back
briefly
into animation.
It's quite odd. There's some kind of, I don't know if it's bones or just like charred ashen ruins.
Yeah, that was the bit. That it was a kind of blackened, charred wood that then turned into a crow's wing.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty textural.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's after they burned down. I love that the Irish are like, oh, can we make up imprisoning your sister for you by building you big house? We should build you a big house that you fit in, and then it will get burnt down.
So
I think for me, it's right towards the end when Sleifal Guffes has continued just having the most bewildering time. Just absolutely bewildering. And he's like a hawk tucked up in a tree while his adoptive mum dad, Gwydion the Wizard, is like, look, mate, I'm really sorry, but I love you. Can you come down here so that I can make it so you don't die? And he's just up there like, I wasn't equipped to deal with where we started with this. And I am not equipped to deal with where it's ended up. But actually, yeah, no, I would like a hug. And there's just something about that that really gets me. And Gwydion just being like, I'm sorry, you've never really had a choice, and this is your first go at having a choice. Will you please come down here so that I can make this better? I don't know if that counts as a texture, but tree leaves and my own tears would be my texture of the week. Because, how are you meant to know how to deal with that?
Red. Yeah.
Yeah, this is the third strand. This is Shay, Matthew Rhys, who in the real life beginning finds out he's adopted, so his Welsh fantasy counterpart is also dealing with parental woes.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to unwrap there. Because there is really something to be said of Gwydion being like the major wizard who like takes care of Shay. That he kind of is the archetype of a parent who's really, really good with kids, but doesn't quite understand that one day they're going to be adults, and that you need to prepare them for being adults. But yeah, poor Shay is a child born in shame whose mother completely was just like, I'm not having anything to do with this. Get my trauma baby away from me. And within his culture, the only person that can name a child is their mother, and the only person that can give them arms, like weaponry, make them a warrior, is their mother. And his mum doesn't want anything to do with him. So Gwydion finds ways of tricking her by using illusions to make it look like him and the child who will be called Clay are different people in the first case. And I think we were talking about earlier how he's clearly decided what he wants this child to be called and so engineers a situation that's really long-winded. Like, oh, he just, like, pinned a sparrow to a bit of wood with a pin from 300 yards. He's got a good hand, hasn't he? He's good with his hands. Ah, would you call him Mr. Good with his hands? That's his name now.
Yeah.
And there really is just a great deal of someone's good intentions really colliding with their lack of emotional intelligence to create a bit of a compounded omni-shamble of this young man's life.
Yeah, both Shay and Rhiannon have a difficult time in the other world. There's Rhiannon's baby, well, the skeleton horse monster tries to steal her baby. That actually the skeleton's hand is hacked off with the baby, like, inside, but people don't know that the baby's still alive.
Yeah, so skeleton horse monster, hobby horse, if you will, steals the baby, like, makes all the nursemaids fall asleep, nicks the baby, and then goes to try and steal the foal of a friend of theirs who's gone back to make sure that his mare foals safely, and the man is there looking after his horses, got to look after him, and he hacks off the hand of the terrifying monster and is like, oh, the baby! I guess we're keeping it. Because him and his wife haven't been able to have children. So they're like, well, miracle horror baby's here. Might as well look after it. And then, considering that he saw Poison and was like, oh, I've got to go home and make sure that my mare, like, foals all right, see you later, and then doesn't come back for 7 years.
When the nursemaids wake up and they find the baby gone, they decide they're all going to stick together on the lie that Rhiannon destroyed her own baby.
Yeah.
So they sort of... So this is some more horror. Get some more,
yeah.
Like, yeah, it's quite quite distressing, actually, yeah.
Yeah, so they sort of get some animal blood and sort of put it on her hands, and she wakes up and they're like, oh, don't you remember what you did, you know?
Yeah, they basically gaslight her into thinking she had some sort of, like, a terrible postpartum psychosis. Mm. And her husband never believes that that's the case, but the court of their community finds her guilty, and her punishment is to sit at the gates of their settlement and tell everyone who comes what she did. And she gobs off, as you would. And an additional punishment is put onto her that she has to carry everyone who comes to visit the court on her back for 7 years. So your man with the foal who ended up with the baby comes to visit after 6 years and is like, oh, look, this child sure does look like my old friend. Maybe I did kind of know about this.
Yeah, at which point, yeah, reunited with Rhiannon and named Pideri.
Yeah.
So
in a very lovely, like, Pryder is like a worry or a care, like, as in you've got all the cares in the world, and she's just like, well, you coming back has taken them all away, so you are all my cares, like, aww. It's all redeemed in your return, which is like lovely, and also like, wow, that is some taking the high road there. I do note that those nursemaids are not seen again.
Yeah.
I don't remember what happens to them, but they're gone.
Yeah, meanwhile in Ireland, Branwen is being punished for the horse killing actions of her. I think he's our uncle. Is he our uncle?
I think his brother.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So after Horsegate, Branwen has been married to Matholwch, and he's like, well, why would you do such a humiliating thing after I've married your sister? It's like, we didn't plan this. He's a nutter. Can we just give you this ominous magic cauldron to make it up to you? And they're like, yeah, no, we're sorted. This is all good. We will not take any vengeance.
Hmm.
And that's kind of a recurring theme in this, is because it's something that is very important in sort of clan-based cultures in modern times as well as in the past. It's like, no, if you say we're good, then we're good. And if you say we're good in front of people, then we're good. And if you go back on that, it's important that stories contain the consequences of going back on your word that we are forgiven. But yeah, they go back to Ireland and decide, actually, we're not good. Let's take it all out on the sister. So they separate her from her child. And she works in the kitchen and is abused the whole time. But she nurses a starling back to health, and sends that starling back over the Irish Sea with a message to her giant older brother, who becomes very large. Like, really very large.
Yeah. And stomps across across the sea.
Yeah, and then becomes a bridge.
And then becomes a bridge.
The one who leads must be a bridge. And I assume that was like an emotional bridge or some kind of moral bridge. But no, I should have taken it far more literally. The one who leads must be a bridge.
Fun fact. So when I was in primary school, I was quite tall for my age, which in combination with the amount of group performance that is within the Welsh education system meant that I would be included in various things because it was handy to have someone who it was handy to have a girl that was quite big and who was quite biddable. So I featured in the school choir as the point of the triangle, but wasn't allowed to sing. And in a performance of a long spoken word poem about this, like Stoddy Branwen, I was Bendigeidfran and had to be the bridge. So like we were all stood together, like reciting this poem really dramatically, and then at this point, I would then step to the right and then lie down on the floor and be a bridge, and everyone else would like march next to me, thankfully.
Not oh, good, yeah.
But just sort of march next to me. And then I think I would just get up again and then stand next to them and then die.
Amazing.
And like, all you've got to be is like 5'8" when you're 10. And this could all be yours.
You too could be a bridge.
You too can be a bridge and an apex.
But yeah, but when the Irish crew see this increasingly giant brother, they decide,
oh no, we made a mistake.
and they said, oh, how about, yeah, we'll build you a giant house. But then they sneakily decide to hide men in the house.
As bags of flour, yeah. Because there's a horrible bit where one of the cat is like, oh, it's just a bag of flour, and then crushes the person inside his skull.
This is our friend Efnesian, the horse slasher.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not convinced that by the good intentions of these Irish people.
That's some lumpy flour.
And he just goes around and methodically crushes
all their skulls.
Crushes all of their skulls.
Yeah, in the
you were hiding in these flour sacks.
In the version, the original Welsh version, it also had subtitled sound effects. So yeah, it said sound of body being crushed.
Yeah, the subtitles really were a highlight for me. I it was memory lane. CFAX AAA Welsh
I think my favourite one was the cries of past woes.
Oh
as
yes, the cries of past woes.
Yes.
Yeah. There was also like a very oh, this is why they gave it a 12 rating bit of animation wherein they go to like the congratulations on your house feast, and the scene begins on one of these quote bag of flour, pans down it to a large droplet of blood forming, which has in it reflected the scene of the room, and then the camera pans to the room and it's like, wow, that is intense, guys. that is some intense animation there.
Yeah. And then like during this sort of betrayal feast, Matholwch opens like all these bags of flour to try, I guess the men are meant to jump out and start fighting, but this really quite graphically crushed corpse slides out of the bag instead.
Yeah, just slumps.
Yeah. But
And like Matholwch is genuinely like, at least voice acted, like really horrified. Like, I was not expecting this. These are people I know. And we were about to do an awful thing, but I'm not thinking about the Welsh like they're people. Like, I'm thinking these corpses and bags are people. Like, it's really quite visceral. Because that's probably like a lot of members of his extended family.
Yeah.
This leads to a big fight, and they have the cauldron because they were given the cauldron,
the black cauldron, which we met in the episode Matty was on before, where we talked about the Disney film, The Black Cauldron.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you think I'm here for the Welsh episodes. I'm actually just here for the cauldron episode. All about the cauldron.
So they kind of have this big fight, and the soldiers start coming back to life out of this cauldron.
Yeah, they come back to life, but they're all mute, like they can't speak.
Mm. Efnisien in the end destroys the cauldron, and
he does also throw his nephew in a fire.
He did do that, yeah.
He did also do that. Bramwen is having...
Yeah.
This really is a myth about how men make women's lives miserable. Archetypally. Like,
yeah, that was quite a shocking moment. Baby really goes flying. Like, it's quite a sort of quick, sudden, horrid thing.
Yeah, and it's such a sweet moment of, like, him going and sitting in the throne and being just a regular little kid. Efnisien really sort of represents, like a reactionary, antisocial, violent element. Because, like, in many ways, he's not wrong in terms of not trusting Matholwch. It means that he finds the bodies in the bag. Like, he's an anti-hero. You are not meant to like him. He's not like a cool anti-hero. He's like, he ruined everyone's lives by caring more about being a very particular kind of right in a way that is quite uncomfortable for us living at the time that we're living in now. Just like, yeah, we've got some of that going on too.
Yeah.
It's like, you are the worst and none of the ways that you're right matter. But yeah, so he climbs in the cauldron and destroys it.
Vendigeifrin was hit with a poisoned spear.
Yeah.
They cut off his head and take it back to Wales.
Yeah.
Big head, presumably quite heavy to cart around.
Yeah, it looked heavy. And like they go to a magic island.
I would also like to say that Branwen dies of a broken heart on the beach.
Oh, yeah.
That also happens. She sings a very, very sad song about two islands, or two cultures being destroyed because of her. Like, she just takes it all as her fault and dies on the beach. And then all of her surviving relatives go to what I have called the cocaine bender island, where they wish to forget about everything they did, which they do successfully for 8 years until someone breaks the spell and the cries of past woes
enter the dining hall,
and Bendigeidfran dies. Celtic mythology it does not mess around. Really, it has a very, very high body count, and it is very like actions have consequences. How is this comparing to the Black Cauldron for you? Like revisiting another great Cauldron film, like
I mean,
this bit specifically, looking at the Black Cauldron, how are you feeling right now?
I mean, I think the Black Cauldron's much more of a romp than this. Like, I think the Black Cauldron, obviously... Okay, I think it's because the Black Cauldron, for a contemporary viewer, is working within very clear fantasy and kind of gothic-hued fantasy registers, right? It's just like, oh, you've got the spooky castle, and you've got, like, I don't know, like, even the kind of undead warriors look like something you might find in an EC horror comic or something. Like, it's all kind of palatable somehow. Whereas, I think you're right that this film somehow gets across these stories... I don't know, maybe on some level how they were communicated or how they might have felt at the time. Like, yeah, they're not softened. I guess, but I don't know, maybe it's the difference between, like, you know, like a fairy tale is passed down by the oral tradition and then the Disney version of that fairy tale. And this is closer to the stories in the oral tradition.
Hmm.
What do you think, Ren?
I think despite the kind of the live action sort of bookending bit of it, which is a kind of, oh, we're going to wrap this up sort of in a way kind of thing. But apart from that, it's not very concerned with wrapping things up neatly or like parceling up it into sort of very palatable kind of, yeah, stories. And I think like, the way that it cuts between the three different stories, it's like, it sort of, I don't know, feels kind of a bit chaotic and tumbling and like, it feels very rich and like alive, I think, but it's not neat.
Yeah.
What are your memories of, can you remember your experience of watching it for the first time, Matty?
That's an interesting question, because it sort of ties into something that I was thinking about, which is like, this is very much mythic storytelling, so it's archetypal universal themes that are meant to make you feel something about the culture you live in and your place in it.
Yeah.
And you asking that question, like, I don't remember anything factual that I, like, what day it was, where, like, I can't remember anything factual, but I can remember how I felt.
Yeah.
Like, I can remember how it made me feel. Like, I can remember being, like, so sad about Bramwell. And, like, I guess that's kind of part of why I wanted to ask about the Black Cauldron, because obviously, like, Lloyd Alexander, like, was really impressed, like, the canon of Welsh, like, mythic storytelling, like, had a massive impression on him, and he managed to work out how to take elements of that to make a narrative story that you can follow from beginning to middle to end with people in it. You know what they're doing and where they're going and what they're about, and you don't know much about their context because you don't need to. And I find that, I think that's a magnificent skill, and I think it's a very important skill because a lot of culture gets, elements of it get preserved through that process that can then be woven back in later. Whereas this story, like, as we're talking about it, like, it's really difficult, for me at least, to follow through my notes and feel confident that anything that I'm saying is going to make sense to anyone listening. Because it's just, look, I just felt a lot of things about these people who in some ways existed, in some ways never existed, and in some ways always exist. And will never stop existing. And yeah, I feel a lot of respect for the people that made the film of The Black Cauldron, and a lot of respect for everyone who's ever tried to grapple with this sort of text, because, like, how do you do that? Like, because you're trying to make people feel something beyond whether or not they can tell you the story in a linear way, if that makes sense. And, like, that's, humans have achieved a few miracles. I think music is one of them, and I think, like, this sort of storytelling is one of them.
Oh, thank you. That was quite moving.
Yeah.
Thanks. Because I was going to follow it up with, also, I love that, like, in the film of The Black Cauldron, the person that breaks the cauldron is the cute comedy, like, scruffy little guy, and in this one it's the worst person you have ever met.
Yeah.
And I'm really curious as to how that decision was made.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
I kept thinking about it while I was watching Evnissian doing stuff, because I remembered that was what he was going to do, and I was like, you're Gergi. your character inspired Gergi, which inspired Gollum. What is art?
before we wrap up, I should mention, just because it's of interest, that the soundtrack was, I believe, done by John Cale.
Yeah, it was.
So there we go. We have Welsh co-founder of the Velvet Underground doing the soundtrack.
Yeah, he sure gets around.
We should also mention that Dan meticulously makes a mouse gallows. Just, I think that's important to our listeners.
Oh, that is important to our listeners. You're right. You know our listeners, mouse gallows. To hang a little mouse that's not really a mouse, but someone's wife.
And it's genuinely, I think, one of the best bits of the film.
That bit is really good, actually, yeah.
Like, no, like, you cannot move me. Like, I know what I'm doing. actually, like, the reasons for it are revealed, and it is resolved in a way that is good for him, everyone. It's good for reality.
Yeah.
Like, reality is restored, but it's just, like, such a... It's just this guy being like, no, I'm going to... I don't care if I look unreasonable. I don't care if I look insane. I'm going to build this mouse gallows until I get what I want. It's just like...
Do you think that's what I should have done in terms of hanging on to my new job today.
I think that's what we should all do at all times. But
I just sat there staring at the woman from HR while building a tiny gallows for a mouse.
Yeah.
Because what else are you going to do? Like, literally, what else are you going to do? Like, I absolutely think going home and going like, no, I'm not dealing with this is a really good response to that sort of situation. But there's no talking to them, there's no reasoning, there's no negotiating. Build a mouse gallows. Like, just stop responding to unreasonable people with reason. It's really weird until they go away. It's like, I'm just going to be weird and difficult until you stop lying. Now give me all my friends back. Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. There's a good message, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Just build the mouse gallows. And we've completely... Everyone listening, just go and watch this. It's on YouTube. You will get the joy of knowing that someone has done a VHS rip of this. In many ways, I think that's great because a lot of the effects, a lot of the CGI probably looks as good as it does to how, for us watching it, because it's from a VHS. So it's not a DVD on it. It's within the technology it was made for. Just watch it. It's great.
No, you're right though, because it's like when you get those Blu-ray editions. Like 4K Blu-ray editions of Video Nasties. It's like, I really don't think the special effects were made to be scrutinised at that level.
No! Or even worse, like, no, the person who did these special effects gave themselves a mental breakdown trying to work out how to make a bucket full of meat scraps look horrifying on VHS.
Yeah.
Like, this was done the way it was done on purpose. It doesn't need to be in 4K.
Yeah.
A woman is brought into existence and then cast out of it to try and... Oh, it's just... Yeah, Blood Awed is... In the time of AI and people... Having like perfect, like I can see how it happens. Like having a lot of their emotional needs met through constructed means. It's a good story in that, like, no one looks good in it, and also no one. You can kind of see where everyone's coming from. It's a mess. It's again, it's just consequences. But yeah, Blood Awed gets done dirty.
And then that
leads you into Alan Garner. And the Owl Service.
Yeah, of course. We need to do the Owl Service at some point. Maybe you can come back and do the Owl Service, Matty.
You know what? I've never actually read the Owl Service. No, you know what? I have. I have the Owl Service. It's just from a bit of my life that I don't remember.
Have you watched it?
No.
Oh, there's a watching format.
There's a TV version.
Where is it from?
Oh, it's from the 70s. So
yeah.
Yeah. Yes. It's proper.
Cool. Right. Yeah. Well, that sounds like a good future project.
Yeah. Thank you, Matty.
Yeah, thank you.
Ren and Adam for and you, dear listeners, in your homes, living your beautiful individual lives. Swimming in archetypes and retaining your selfhood. Well done. That wasn't easy. Good job. Thanks for putting up with me getting a bit intense about things. And shout out Richard Bro's coaches that I loudly popped for in the start of the live action bit when one of the buses comes past. I'm like, oh, I've probably been on that bus to Cardigan. Go to Pembrokeshire. Go to Wales. Go to the 70s. Someone buy me a ladder. It's so hot.
Right. I'll so our intro music's by Maki Yamazaki, our outro music's by Joe Kelly, our artwork's by Letty Wilson. You can email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at stillscaredpodcast. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Yeah, you too can be a bridge, creepy kids. Go and be a bridge.
Yeah, be a bridge, creepy kids.
Yeah. Be a bridge.
Catch you next time. Bye.